Oh, hey, I'm glad you're here. I was just thinking about how we all have these moments where we've seen an image on TV or something in a movie, and it burns a hole in us. It becomes something we obsess about. It's either that we're repulsed by it or that we're drawn into it. We build this passion within us, and we have to know answers. We want to know stories. We want to know, you know, everything we can about this. I recently saw my daughter go through this with the movie Spirited Away. There's a part where Haku is a dragon and he's spitting blood everywhere. And she obsessed over this and she would tell people about it and how she was so brave that she could see it and other people might get a little scared. And it was so wonderful to see her become so passionate and have to know answers. And we got the book and it became her bedtime story. And that's the way some of us watched movies on VHS. We would have a copy at home and we would watch it over and over and over and over. You know, and that could be Bette Davis in Watcher in the Woods, which is terrifying, or John Stamos, you know, smoldering on screen and never too young to die. It can also be how we explore and find new things. The movie Chocolate War can introduce a whole generation of people to the music of Yaz. Or Dudes, you know, Penelope Spheeris' film starring John Cryer and Daniel Roebuck has a Flea cameo, and people might see it and be like, oh my gosh, Flea was in movies? And that could lead them to Penelope Spheeris' film Suburbia, which is fantastic. There's just different ways that these things can weave in and out of us, and I think it's so interesting. And some of these conversations that we have on this program are all about that. And I didn't intend that to happen. It's just what's in all of us somewhere in some way. So today's episode is Auntie Mame, the guest, a fashion designer, and this is VHS. Hello, and welcome to VHS. I'm your host, Dirk Marshall, and I'm joined in the studio by Michelle Lesniak, who is a fashion designer.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
People can find out more about you on your website, michellelesniak.com. You're Michelle as well on Instagram and Twitter. Is there any other resource people could find you at?
I mean, I don't really tweet. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't want my words to disappear if they're
going
to disappear. But I'm on there, and then, yeah, my website. And yeah, that's about it.
Okay. Yeah, I have Twitter too, but I mostly just click on it and then see people really mad and then I just close it. In addition to being a designer, you were also on Project Runway season 11 in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah and I were very excited because we had heard that, oh, we got someone from Portland that's on the show. And so we got cable and we watched you win.
Oh, yay!
And we were very excited. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Recently, I looked up articles and people have recapped the whole season and put, it's a great resource because they put your designs from all the different challenges sort of side by side. And it's fun to see like a progression of someone's design work. If you're not design minded to see.
Oh my
like,
gosh, you have to give me this because I have not seen that.
Oh, I'll show you. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And as well as that, oh, I just wanted to ask. So that was 2013.
Yes.
That's your first foray into television.
Yes.
Is that considered reality TV being a competition? I'm always confused by
it
this.
It is reality TV. Yeah.
Okay.
And this one is actually real. They don't tell you what to say. They
okay.
don't put you in forced like fights.
Yes.
We're fighting because we're just really tired.
Yeah.
We're filming from 5 a.m. till 1 a.m. And so you get 4 hours of sleep a night. Can you imagine doing that week after week after week? It's pretty brutal.
It's like being a parent.
That's what I tell people. Definitely, if you have a child, it's like being that first 2 years of your
man.
Life. Yeah, but in 8 weeks.
And then recently, you were on Project Runway All-Stars, where you won again.
I did, and it was all winners this time. So it was winners from around the world, because they do, like, there's Project Runway London, there's Project Runway Brazil, and so they had all, I think it was like 7 winners from the States and 7 winners from all over the world.
Wow.
It was really incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that was happening because of how cable and
I know.
Everything works these days. But then that second you won, all of Portland is like, yay!
Yay, she was there!
Yay!
We had a bit of a hard time because it didn't air for a full, almost 2 years after we filmed it.
What?
I know. There's something called Harvey Weinstein. Can I swear?
Yeah.
Okay, fucking Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
he ruined it for everybody.
Oh, my gosh.
And not only was he, like, the company, it was the Weinstein that does Project Runway, his wife was also a judge. So you can imagine, as soon as we got done filming, all that shit hit that fan, and we're still reeling from it.
That's insane.
I know.
I mean, I was going to ask later on just the regular, like, lag time in his show, because, like, we both know Gregory Gaudette, chef at Departure, and he was on a cooking competition show, and... that, you know, they get to that final challenge and they can't say who won. And so I was like curious what that time frame is from when you wrap the show and when they actually, this time it was 2 years?
It was almost 2 years, yeah.
That you'd known you won.
Yeah, and I had to sit on it.
That's so insane.
I know. And you also don't get any of your winnings until it airs. So, like, you're waiting on that, like, whatever it is that you would win, like, let's say $100,000, you're waiting until that last episode airs before they even start cutting a check.
That's insane.
And if you want to get real, real dirty, because the Weinsteins went bankrupt and all 47 of his companies went bankrupt,
no.
I'm in line with a lot of people trying to get that money. So, yeah, it's dirty.
That's so uncomfortable.
I know, just because he wanted to show his penis to everyone.
Yeah.
It's so gross. So
it's,
gross.
It's really gross.
It's super gross.
It's weird also that a lot of those things seem to have come out at the same time, that mm-hmm. there's this thing of people. I'm the type of person that puts more clothes on at the beach.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
me too. I'm not one of those people that would even be remotely close to wanting to expose my stomach to people, much less something lower. So I was just shocked. Yeah. I was just like, this is what people are doing. They're just like going around to house plants and it's just insane.
Yeah. I mean, so even though I didn't see his, he's still affecting me with his dick.
Sure. That's awful.
Mm-hmm.
And then something I wanted to touch on up top is if there's one takeaway I hope to have from this podcast is that people listening who are interested in these different professions mm-hmm. would be hopefully willing to take a step rather than hindered by people's opinions or criticisms and things like that. And as somebody who designs things, I'd imagine that there are fashion critics and people that have looked at pieces that you've done. But more so, how do you deal with whatever it's called that comes from the internet?
Never go on the internet.
Okay.
You're going to get killed on that thing.
Yeah.
Do not read it. In fact, what's his name for Maroon 5? Tattooed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
Adam Levine,
yeah. I was at a party once and he was there. This is not me name dropping by any means, but his advice to me was don't ever read the internet. Don't go on there. Don't see what people say because they're mean and they're hiding behind their computer.
Mm-hmm.
If people really want your work, they're going to buy it no matter what. And I don't love everything.
Sure.
But I'm not going to go after people and hate on their, their production. So, just don't go on that thing.
Ugh, yeah.
It's gross.
I just think that's really helpful because even in putting anything out in the world, there's going to be self-doubt and there's going to be part of you that's like, oh, what am I doing? And then to have people pile on that, it can just be so unhealthy.
As an artist, I think the hardest thing is getting out of bed every day and feeling good and positive about your work. So you don't need somebody else, knocking you down because it's already a tough job.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the people who are maybe, I don't want to say better adjusted, but I will, are going to have less time to pile on negative things on people. It's usually people who are very unhappy to begin with. But I'm so glad that you're here, not only
Thank
to
you.
Talk about this movie, but because of your fashion knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've been on TV and so many images of your work exist, and I think you're very, very talented.
Shucks.
But me, I get so confused by like when things are new, but they were old, when old things are new again, when like suddenly the 90s come back. And I just curious for you, like, do you look at trends and things? Do you just keep your head down?
Hell no on the trends. And I think the greatest thing about this, quirky internet, is that you can find what you want without having to go to a big box store.
Yeah.
So if you want to dress totally in Japanime, you can find that. It might not be trend focused of what's happening right now,
mm-hmm.
but I think trends are the killers and that's what end up in our landfills. I try to go with an emotional design. So I find the things that I keep in my closet for the longest time are things that have emotion. So it's tied to a dance that I went to or one of my weddings that I've had. more than one. And I just like that emotive clothing that has a story behind it are the pieces that I'm going to keep. So I'm trying not to design for super fast, super trend now, because I think that's disgusting. And the clothing industry is the second most garbage producing industries out there. And we need people to be smarter and spending a little bit more on things, getting things repaired, having them tailored, as opposed to just going out and getting a t-shirt for $5.
Yeah.
It's not helping anything.
We started, we asked around and some people recommended someone in Portland, and we started, Sarah and I, taking pieces that we haven't been wearing because they had, you know, wear and tear and holes and things, and actually having them fixed rather than buying four shirts that we don't love as much. You know, we just spend that money to have something. Although one time I did get some drop crotch pants, and I'm 5'6", so drop crotch pants didn't look the best.
No.
I was a little too genie-y.
Yeah.
So I had the crotch taken up.
Oompa Loompa-like,
yes,
maybe?
Yes, yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. So I had the crotch undropped, and then the whole piece was so bizarre that I would wear it around the house, but even then Sarah's like, what is happening there? But at that point I'm like $200 into a thing, so I'm like, well, it's gonna be, you know, this is what it
make
is.
Make it work.
I just oompa loompa around the house and that's what happens. And then really quickly before we move on, here's a hot fashion opinion from someone without any sort of fashion design.
Okay.
I like culottes.
Mm-hmm.
And even gauchos, I'm ride or die with. But palazzo pants can burn in hell.
Wow. Those are just different lengths.
Right?
Like, why you just palazzo, just that little bit longer of a length, you're ready to, like, kill it.
I love just having an opinion that has, like, really no basis whatsoever. And then I would like to go so far as to call them designer JNCOs.
Oh, I love the JNCO. It's like of my era.
I know. It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
I do say, though, like, when I was in high school and I was making all my clothing or, you know, editing them, paring them down and whatnot that I would get at Goodwill, I had these opinions, like, I will never wear a pointy shoe.
Oh.
Guess what? Damn, I love a pointy shoe now. Yeah. I will always, like, I always said, I hate the color yellow. Guess what? It's one of my favorite colors now. So I feel like you can't be too set in those ideas because they're going to change eventually.
Yeah. How did you free yourself up to being open to that?
I think it was from movies like Anti-Mame.
Okay.
Honestly, and the costume world, and just that you can be whoever you want and you can look ridiculous. I mean, we're lucky we live in Portland, so we can look ridiculous.
Yeah.
But just like, don't put yourself in a box.
Sure.
I might not wear like, what is that like onesie swimsuit thing that the guys have with the
a singlet?
Yeah. I might not do that.
Sure. Well.
But I think that's fair that I shouldn't do that.
I wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
We've already covered that.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, because I have my own hangups. I don't think corduroy should be something. I don't think people should wear brown pants. I think there's huge difference between corduroy and denim, because you can double down on denim, but if you double down on corduroy, you look like a couch.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's... But I guess I just need to be open. I guess
that's what we need to touch on. Maybe one of these days, maybe 10 years from now, I'm going to see you walking down, double down on their corduroy, and you're going to be like, oh, Michelle, I said I wouldn't do it, but now look at me.
Yellow corduroy. I might even go that far.
Oh, God, I love yellow.
That might work, actually, in a suit. Okay, well... Clearly, those opinions that I have aren't grounded in anything. And if anyone has doubts about my fashion, you can check the Instagram hashtag 90s Dirk, where I have documented my my 90s looks.
Mm.
There was a lot of very interesting ones. But we aren't here just to talk about my problems with boho fringe tops. We are here to talk about a film. And the film that brings us together is Auntie Mame. The premise of this program was that I interview a person whose profession is portrayed in the film, but when I reached out to you, you suggested this film because of its profound impact on you.
Much so.
And who am I to say no to that conversation?
Mm-hmm.
So I watched Auntie Mame for the first time, and I think it can be easily argued that the costume design work of Ori Kelly is an invaluable character to the film.
Not only that, but the man that wrote this. So first, we'll start with Ori Kelly.
Yeah.
He's known for some of my favorite movies, Casablanca, American in Paris, Some Like It Hot, where he dressed two men like women.
Yes.
Yummy. Gypsy, where he had to form her body because she was such a kind of a little boyish figure, he had to make her look curvy. He was kind of a master at doing the fool the eye, the Trump the loyal kind of things.
Yeah.
Oklahoma, don't love the movie, but the costumes were incredible.
Mm-hmm.
He's my favorite costume designer, and he didn't start out in costume or in fashion, and neither did I. I went to school for fine art, as did he. And he left Australia to become an actor. Didn't work out for him. Started painting backdrops and then, boom, landed in some of these, like, the biggest film career.
Yeah. He has 300 credits on IMDb.
Oh, my gosh.
Spanning from 1930 to 1963.
He died tragically young. Unfortunately, he was an alcoholic and liver hit him at a very young age.
Oh.
But his knowledge and what he does and how... Roslyn Russell in Anti-Mame is the aunt I always wanted and am to be.
How old were you when you first saw Anti-Mame?
It was probably in middle school. We always had Turner Classic Movie Channel on because even though there's a lot of dark things that they, you know, move around in guises, it was like good for kids.
Yeah.
You know, you can't tell what's happening. These are, you know... It's all tucked in fancy wording. So it was always on, and it was something that my grandmother, my mother, and I could watch together. But Anti-Mame, oh, man. The first time when she runs down that half-spiral staircase with her cigarette lighter, and she's like, I'm your Anti-Mame.
Yeah.
It's everything you want to be.
I wrote down, she enters at 11. Like, she is at such a peak. Straight off the go. There's no like limping into Anti-Mame. It's
no.
Like she is on fire from the second it starts.
And that her speech and her talk and
knowledge,
she's got, you know, a priest there from Lithuania or, you know, like all the choreographers and teachers and artists. I mean, she just lived life to its fullest. And I loved that idea as a young girl and just seeing what she wore.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Pretty amazing. So I could see that you would get inspired by the costume aesthetics of Anti-Mame, but I was curious about when you design, do you design in silence? Do you listen to music? Do you listen to podcasts? How do you work in a coffee shop, in your studio?
It usually starts on an airplane.
Oh.
I travel a lot and I think, and on an airplane, I'm stuck in a spot where I cannot move and I have to be focused. And when I go about designing, I go about it with an emotion. I think about how I'm feeling at that moment in time.
Okay.
And then take it and make a word board. So I try to write a story down and use words and then go back to that word board to come up with the next collection.
Whoa.
So I use words because it keeps me focused. It's hard as a designer. You're constantly thinking of different things, but going back to a word board, it's like, let's say it's metal, hard, cold, like sad, whatever the words are that I come up with. That's what I use to buy my fabric. That's what I use to start sketching with.
Wow.
I did a collection called Weather Worn because I was getting really worn out and I was traveling way too much. And so I thought about what is the most weather worn century or era, and I thought of the 1940s and the Great Depression. And so I used that as my imagery to come up with my designs. So I start with words, well, first on a plane.
Yes.
Usually a glass of wine, stuck there in a seat, trying not to elbow the people next to me because I'm usually in that darn middle seat. And it goes from there.
That's awesome. So before we get too far into the film, let's just put things in context a little bit. Anti-Mame was from 1958. The director was Morton DaCosta. Morton did Anti-Mame 1958, Music Man in 1962, which is crazy, back-to-back. Island of Love in 63. Not much else. The cinematographer is Harry Stradling. He did, just to name a few things, A Streetcar Named Desire in 1951,
geez.
Guys and Dolls in 55,
gorgeous.
Anti-Mame in 58, Gypsy in 62.
Oh, Ori Kelly worked on that one too,
Island of Love in 63, My Fair Lady in 64, and Hello, Dolly in 69.
And there's some big credits.
Yeah, it's crazy. Actor, we got to start with Rosalind Russell.
Oh my goodness. She's She did it on stage.
Yeah.
And then also did the movie. I mean, she is the epitome of Auntie Mame. And yeah. I know there's one other actress that did, they did another knockoff, and I haven't watched it, and I refuse to.
Yeah. Well, there was also the musical.
Yes. Haven't
Mame.
Seen.
I didn't see it, but when I saw who was in it, if I could travel back in time, and I don't like musicals, but Angela Lansbury is the main role, and her support is Bea Arthur.
Oh, yes, I do know that. Haven't seen it, though.
Yeah, I haven't. I just saw a still from it, and I would love to have.
It's just so hard, because I've read the book hundreds of times. I give them to my friends. I've watched the movie hundreds of times.
Yeah.
That I can't see anyone else but Rosalind Russell.
Well, and for me, Angela Lansbury is pretty clean, and I feel like Rosalind in the
dirty.
Role. Yeah, she's owning it as much as she can in 1958.
Oh, I mean, there's gin that's getting dropped off. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
You know there's more than gin.
Oh, like, yeah. She's been all over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She did a lot in her career, but just to name a couple, she did Picnic in 56, Auntie Mame in 58, Gypsy in 62, and The Trouble with Angels in 66 with Hayley Mills, who I adored as a kid. Actor Forrest Tucker, this dude did TV, so much television, it's out of control. F Troop, Columbo, Bonanza, Night Gallery,
Columbo,
Kojak,
yeah.
And it just goes on and on and on. For movies, you would see Auntie Mame in 58, Strange World of Planet X, Fort Massacre, Girl in the Woods, The Crawling Eye, Gunsmoke and Tuscan. That was all 58, so that's six movies. And his career just is cranking them out like that. Also, Coral Brown and Fred Clark are in this movie, but I really wanted to move on to Peggy Cass.
Who plays Agnes Gooch,
yes.
Not only on stage, but also in the movie version.
Oh, really?
Yes. There are three people that did the stage and then went straight to the movie. Rosalind Russell, Peggy Cass, who does Agnes Gooch.
Oh, I love Gooch.
She's just, Dr. Pepper, just give me a Dr. Pepper. And then the gentleman that plays Ito, he was also in the original.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I could totally see that.
He's so funny.
He's great. Yeah, I'm totally a Gooch head. Might start a Tumblr for all the Goochers out there. She was also in Gidget Goes Hawaii in 1961 and did a bunch of television, but I think Agnes Gooch might be the role for her. The film can be found on Amazon, Google Play, iTunes, and YouTube, as well as Blu-ray and DVD.
I've got the DVD version, and then I also have it from Amazon because I always need it near me. And I will, I'm not going to lie, I once did mushrooms and watched Auntie Mame, and it was even better.
Was it in color?
Yeah, the Technicolor version.
Nice. Ugh. That's what I watched it in. The synopsis of the film is an orphan goes to live with his free-spirited aunt. Conflict ensues when the executor of his father's estate objects to aunt's lifestyle. Kind of boils it down into just a couple words.
Yeah.
But, so where would you like to start?
Well, first I'd like to talk about the writer of this book.
Yeah.
He had a few different noms de plumes, but his real name is Edward Everett Tanner III. I can't imagine being the third of anything, but
no.
He wrote it under the name Patrick Dennis, which is actually this boy's name in the movie. So it's
Whoa.
Taken in first person,
okay.
But that's his false name that he's using for the book, as I brought here for you today to see.
Yes, thank you.
So cute.
I'll take a picture of that.
He led a double life. He was married. He had two children, but he was actually homosexual.
Okay.
And because he wrote under the pseudonym, nobody knew that he was the actual person. So when his wife found out that he was gay, she took the children and they didn't speak to him ever again.
Oh.
Until he passed. The books went out of fashion, even though he did make quite a bit of money. He, towards the end of his life, ended up being the CEO of McDonald's butler. So he lived this very quiet, private life. Nobody
wow.
knew, as he was being this butler, that he wrote all of these books, including this beautiful Auntie Mame. And you can see when you read the book and you start looking at the movie, he's writing it as if he's Auntie Mame. Like, that
yeah.
is who he wants to be.
Okay, so I watched it, and I didn't pick up on a lot of things. And then I started reading articles. And one of the articles I read was from Les Fabian, and you can find it on IndieWire. It's called Hazed, Decoding the Classics.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's about Auntie Mame. It says, an irreverent escapade by Patrick Dennis, and then he has the nom de plume there, who was inspired by his own aunt, Marion Tanner. The literary Mame is far bodier and brassier broad than her celluloid incarnation. Dennis, himself a bisexual, imbued Mame with a gay sensibility that somehow connected with stuffy, conservative, McCarthy-era post-war Americans. She invites transvestites to her parties, associates with famed homosexual artists and writers while making veiled lesbian allusions to her relationship with Gal Friday, Agnes Gooch.
I don't know if he was bisexual or homosexual. I just...
That might be some way of just shortening the wife, kids, to gay transition in one
simple... The book now, his son, actually after he passed, wrote a foreword, which is really, really lovely for those that pick up the book. Because he just lived this secret life, and that freaking sucks.
Yeah.
And he had this aunt... Auntie Mame, who taught the world and loved life. And
loved life,
her
yeah.
favorite, the one tagline for the whole movie is, life is a banquet and most poor suckers are starving to death.
Yeah, I made that note too.
It's such a great line. And I'm like, yeah, most people are starving to death. They're like hiding in their holes and being all conservative. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like just open it up. And Auntie Mame did that.
Yeah.
I mean, gosh, what she did to Agnes Gooch when she dressed her up and sent her out of the town. Woo!
It's so good.
Getting Gucci.
In Les Fabian's article, he also notes that there's lesbians in the party. They're kind of tucked into the corners, he says. But for 1958 and the Hays Code being in effect, it is very notable that there are gays on screen.
Yes.
In a major motion picture. So I think I got goosebumps when I read that because I just... Like, they did it. Like
they did.
They got a representation on the screen, no matter how tiny it was. In 1958, that's pretty amazing.
They also, Auntie Mame has her nephew, Patrick Dennis, write down lists of words that he doesn't understand. And there's like...
Well, and you use words to design.
Yeah, I do. Like, narcissist and, like, heterosexual. And he's, like, writing down all of these very, very hot topic words in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty mind-blowing how future-forward that movie is.
Yeah. Yeah. And just her entrance from the staircase, as you were talking about, she comes in and shakes hands with a monkey and doesn't even break her stride. Or it's so... It's just the monkey handshake was fantastic and a good band name.
Really? she's a very comedic actress.
Yes.
Yeah. She just nailed it. Oy.
It's so good. And then there's so many quick jokes happening just constantly. And I love movies like that because you can continually rewatch and find things that you missed or jokes that they parked in certain places that have punchlines that are, it's just so well crafted and coming from Broadway. Mm-hmm. You know, that makes sense.
Yeah. How she messes too at the end with, you know, here's her nephew who's grown now and he's engaged to this, you know, waspy girl who's lived in this like top drawer ghoul, you know,
yeah.
and she's has not lived and has not traveled. And Auntie Mame, how she like circumvents herself into breaking up their relationship is just brilliant.
Yeah, it's so good. I actually made a top drawer note because everyone keeps saying, you know, being top drawer, they're not top drawer. And I would like to pitch a program that you host where it's about if people are top drawer. And it could be a competition show, a design show, where it's like, are you top drawer? And like, no, I'm sorry, you're just not top drawer.
Well, what's in your top drawer?
I don't have a dresser.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Then I can't judge you on your top drawer.
Yeah.
What's your favorite drawer in the kitchen?
Probably there's a drawer that's just like bento box tools because I like to make these very ornate lunches for my daughter.
Yeah.
Because she likes monsters, so I make like monster sandwiches and things
Gorgeous.
Like that. So probably that drawer because it's ridiculous and it's a bunch of things that like most dads, I would guess, wouldn't get excited to be like, hey, what do you want? She's like, I want a mummy sandwich. And I'm like, cool. Yeah. That's what will be in your lunch tomorrow.
Creative.
So that's what I like.
My top drawer in my bedroom is a mixture of underwear that's really ill-fitting, handkerchiefs, and my passport. Like, I kind of tuck my passport
in
the back.
It's like an erotic magician.
Yeah. It's so, yeah, that's that one. And then my favorite kitchen drawer is definitely the one with all the sauce packets.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's
condiments.
Fun drawer.
You can dress up your food. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So
tab to eye.
we covered the book to Broadway to film, but just for the years, the book was 55, Broadway in 56, the film in 58, the musical in 66.
Ooh.
How many books were there?
Thousands. I mean, he was, I think, the first person to have three books on the top, or New York Times bestseller. It came out of fashion in like the 60s, 70s, and then it just recently came back. We all have that saying, oh, the book is better than the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But I will tell you that this book is just as good as the movie. I think it does its justice, and it feels, they don't cut anything out. It's the only time I've...
You can feel that. The movie's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. It's crazy.
That fox chasing scene when she's on a horse?
What was
goodness.
How did they do that on Broadway? That's what...
I doubt they did it on Broadway.
Okay, because there were scenes where I was like, this has to be just for the movie. Mm-hmm. Like where they're like, we've got to break it outside of this building. So we'll have her climb a mountain. Does that happen in the book?
She does, yeah. And they do climb a mountain when Beauregard passes away.
Yes, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh,
poor thing.
One step back too far. The beginning, just the opulent kaleidoscope, like beginning to the credits. Like from that scene, I was like, I'm in for whatever this is going to be. It's just gorgeous.
When the very, very beginning, when Nora is bringing, which is Patrick Dennis's, like, I don't know, what do you call it? Nanny.
Yeah.
When the nanny, she's Irish, is bringing him to Auntie Mame's house for the first time, and the door is like this oriental carved dragon, and like smoke snorts out of the door. It's just, oh, gosh, the art director did a really great job.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I love that she holds the cigarette holder and she describes caviar as fishberry jam.
Fishberry jam, yeah.
Oh, man, that's fantastic.
Poor little kid's never had his fishberry jam before. I like it. It's a little salty.
They keep referring to the each other as being hung.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, oh, I'm so hung. So I Googled what it means to be hung, and it's very graphic, and I don't think it's what they meant in 1958.
So I know there's two times the... Auntie Mame asks her nephew, did your dad ever talk to you?
Right.
And he goes, oh, every once in a while in the morning, he would say, pipe down, kid.
Yeah.
Your dad is hung. And then she says it at one point,
yes,
too.
And her friend says it.
Yes. Vera.
Yeah.
Vera Charles. Yeah, they drink a lot of like Manhattans at 9 a.m. I think morning time for her is 1 p.m.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's so true. And then the first time they mention a designer dress, it's Maggie Roof.
Which I'm not familiar with.
So I looked her up, and she was a real designer. She's known for ruffles, shirring, and bias cut, and started a couture fashion house, Dracole. I did an image search. Pretty stunning stuff. But what is shirring?
Shirring is where you take lots of different pieces of thread and you kind of weave it through the fabric and then you pull it together. So it's like almost like doing an accordion with fabric.
Okay.
Yeah. Shearing.
Got it.
Accordioning with your threads.
Shearing. Then
most men don't. It's not like something you would see in gentlemen's clothing.
No. Well, most gentlemen's clothing is pretty boring.
It's true.
Then we have Patrick making a martini.
Oh, gosh, and he's like 8 years old.
It's so great. And he says, stir, never shake. It bruises the gin, which I had to look up because I'm like, why do people always say that? And it's
does it really bruise anything?
The word bruise they're using means it's changing the mouthfeel by aerating the gin is what the bruising means. I never knew that. I just always heard that. But I don't know if this is true, but I feel like the lighting cues in Auntie Mame are the same as they were in the play. Because you keep seeing, I mean, obviously some of it's going to be different, but the closing scenes, there's always this beautiful like fall of light just to surround her on a staircase in the gowns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great because it gives you an extra moment to really appreciate what design went into these pieces. I've never watched a movie where I was, rather than writing down plot points and things, I was writing down costume
lighting,
changes.
Yeah.
You know, I was just, there's one part where I was like, now she's in a green number. Just like, I have no idea what that scene was about, but I was like, the whole time I was mesmerized by what she was wearing.
And when they, at some point in the movie, the stock market crashes and she becomes poor.
Yes.
And you see in her clothing how that changes as well. She becomes a bit more dowdy, less show, less sparkle.
Yeah.
Which he was doing obviously on purpose. And that Christmas scene where
oh my gosh,
she's going to go out to dinner and she picks up that little crappy plastic tinsel and she puts it on her head. Ugh.
Yeah.
Just magic.
When the people that work for her,
Ito and Vera.
Their kindness in that scene, I had like
Nora.
Tears welled up in my eyes. It's so sweet that these people care so much for her. It's just, yeah, it's fantastic.
Sweet little movie. And I try to be, I mean, I'm not as flamboyant as Auntie Mame as opposed, well, I don't know, today I look like a crazy person. but I try to be an Auntie Mame for my nieces and nephews.
Yeah.
You know, I give them the weird gifts and I take them out to have sushi for the first time. I take them to have fishberry jam.
Yeah.
To like really open up their idea and their
possibilities.
World.
Yeah. That's great.
Because I have the joy of being able to do that. I don't have children.
Right.
So I've got more energy.
Yeah. Well, and you could probably enter at 11 like Rosalind
yes.
does, you know, and make an exit and not have to operate at that level at all times and just be that magical being. You know,
I put my nephew, who's 8, in one of my fur coats. It's not fur; it's a fake. It's a faux fur.
No letters.
But it's a bright green faux fur jacket,
oh, that's great.
And he was prancing around the house, and we were taking pictures. And I was like, "This is the auntie that I look up to. The aunties that I've had that are those kind of people that make you dress up and make you have tea, high tea. You know, and, just show you different things."
I grew up in a small town 2 hours south of here. Mm-hmm. And so the goal every time was always to get to Portland. And we would come here in the 90s and go to stores like Big Bang.
Oh, yeah.
And I would put on like the pink giant fake fur coats and be like, oh, this would be so great if cowboys wouldn't beat me up for wearing this in my small town.
London Underground.
Yes. London Underground.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ozone. I loved Portland in the 90s, like so hard. Like,
what town are you from?
Springfield, Eugene.
Area. Yeah, yeah. My husband's from Forest Grove, and so he would take the hour and a half bus to get to Portland so he could skate and hit up all those things.
Yeah, our theater program would go see plays up here, and when we would come up, we'd have an hour for lunch, and I never ate. I ran to Big Bang and Crocodile and Second Avenue and Ozone. And
my goodness. Yeah, we're the same age.
Later, MacBig.
Yeah, MacBig, yeah.
Which you had work at MacBig at one point.
Yeah.
And two of the ladies, I think it's two ladies.
Yes, they are.
Were in, I think, Preservation Society with Sarah, and that's who told us that you were in the Project Runway.
Oh, yeah. So that would have been Cassie and Amy.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
Great girls.
Yeah, Sarah was like, so that's how we found out about it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so crazy that like they were selling some of your work and that's the story that came out, and you won.
And I did.
That's awesome.
I did.
Other outfits I'd like to mention. There's a blue gown with jewelry that's incredible when there's the big double cross and Patrick is taken to.
Yeah.
Then there's the bells with the red outfit and the gray furs on stage. I love that whole sequence with the bells.
And they get stuck in another costume and they're making all this jangling
so
and it's supposed
loud.
To be a very, very serious moment on stage.
Wow.
I loved it.
So good. The circuit board scene, it's short, but it's like one of those pieces that Lucille Ball would have had in a movie where it's just like she's hooking up all the different chords and they're going to the wrong halls and then there's just like this brief little moment. I can't even say all the names. And then she says, Christmas isn't until Tuesday. And she says, we need it now, so let's have it. And I love that because she is all about living. And she's like, if this is what we need right now, then let's celebrate.
It's so wonderful.
Yeah.
It is such a great movie for any age. I mean, there's definitely going to be words that may be a little too big for a child.
Sure.
Like, you know, I don't know, Nietzsche. I don't know if your daughter knows what Nietzsche means.
My daughter doesn't.
No, but it's in there and then you can talk about things and it's a very, very sweet, sweet movie. I mean, there is that one weird school that he was going to at some point where they were nude
yes,
the whole time.
Yes, it is very bizarre when they recount that. But it's a different time.
This was a different time. And Auntie Mame was progressive and looking to do stuff in the future.
I got so nervous when they said the film was going to a plantation.
Mm.
But then I was like, there's probably not a huge intersection of racism and fashion design.
There is racism in the movie, but not by Auntie Mame.
Right,
it was the anti-Semitic.
Yeah, but I was watching from the fashion design aspect,
yeah, yeah.
So then I was just hoping that you weren't going to be like, there's so much racism in fashion design.
There's racism everywhere. It sucks.
That's so bummed.
I know. We need to move forward from like
somewhere where the people are like, no, we're just all really creative and we get along.
Well, I would say my group of friends are really creative and get along, and also really, really, really close. One thing that's great about Portland, as well as other Project Runway designers, is that we all support each other. And you could be having a really bad day, and I could send out an email or a text to one of my friends and being like, I don't know what I'm doing today. I'm like, I'm sitting here amongst all this fabric and I'm crying. And they will reach out and be like, no, you got this. Like, they send the hug. Portland is really great about that. And then my Project Runway family is as well.
And now around the world.
That's, I know.
So fantastic.
I've got couches to sleep on.
Yeah.
I think the next couch is I'm going to go Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Amsterdam, yes. Uh-huh. I'm doing that. And then where else am I? Well, Australia, it's such a long flight.
Yes.
But I've got two couches there. And hey, because I can only be there for like 3 days. And
right.
Then the fish starts to stink and they're going to want to kick you off the couch. So
that makes sense. Moving up to one more fashion question.
Yeah, yeah.
What is up with men's shapeless boxy clothing?
Are you like thinking like
men's jeans? Why are they just stovepipes that go straight down by and large? I mean, I have skinny jeans, but like when you look at just guys buying jeans, they're these like super dated. There's no shape to it. I'm just so confused.
I think it's because it was easy.
It's just what people were wearing.
And it was what people were
wearing. And they don't have to think about it, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of it comes out of, you know, denim was made for workwear.
Right.
So if you think about the workwear fashions and what they needed to wear, were a little looser.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the knees were reinforced. And that kind of shape, you know, think of Carhartts.
Yeah.
That is that, like, it's a big baggy mess.
Yeah.
Of really
maybe it's
thick
the
fabric.
The Portland in me, but I don't think of guys when I think of Carhartts.
I know. I have this idea. I don't know if it's going to happen. I've been talking to a few different companies of doing a new modern workwear.
Yeah.
So they are slimmer, trimmer, but it's also non-binary.
Yeah.
So it's both men, women.
Cool.
Whatever you.
I love that.
Yeah. Cut a little thinner, but still you can work in them and look fashionable because we all want to look nice, right?
Yes. I mean, I try. The Hunt Pin Me series, Fox and Horn.
Mm-hmm.
Which is yours.
Mm-hmm.
Was it connected in any way to the fox and badge in the hunt scene of Auntie Mame?
I think maybe reaching a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, maybe that was in the back of my head, but I always find that, like, I don't know. Once again, I go real personal when I do these collections, and I, you know, at that point in time, you want to get deep?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. So that point in time, the Pin Me, Pierce Me, I was engaged, and that engagement did not work out.
Okay.
And in the 1950s, gentlemen would give a pin as a promise. Like, this is a promise of us getting married. And so this pin pierced me.
Yeah.
And so I used that as a way to get that kind of emotional energy out. It's one of my favorite collections. It's pretty dark. They tend to go fight. Really
yeah.
Dark.
I don't know. It really looks darker.
Yeah, it works for me.
One of the things that is in one of the articles I saw where they were comparing your different designs from, or not comparing, but just setting them up next to each other, was the Bleeding Heart design. And I don't know if you remember it this way, but a lot of the judges were very, very excited about that design.
I still get 10 to 15 emails a day about it.
That's great.
And
that's
it's hard because the sweater would be like $700
sure.
to make. So I do some screen printed t-shirts of it. And I think all of us have a bleeding heart. And I think it feels good to wear it, you know,
yeah.
Show it out loud.
Be proud of it. Her white hat with berries on the cruise was another piece that I saw. And I was just like, that's incredible.
That cloche with those cherries. Oh, it
yeah.
was so good.
The costume changes as they celebrate their marriage. He just like throws in a bunch, like there's not even scenes to it, really. It's just like, bam, 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 just beautiful work, one after another.
She also does a lot of, like, when she's traveling and they're going to, like, Bali or wherever they're going, Indonesia, she wears a lot of culturally appropriate clothing for that time. And even when her house is getting redone and she's got kind of this Indochine look happening in the house. And it's fantastic. It's stunning.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like in that film, it's not an appropriation as much as she is like
a celebration.
Yes. Yeah. She's celebrating. Yeah. And there's a huge difference to that.
Agreed.
Let's see.
It's a conversation that I have a lot with other designers about, because I look to, I did a series of work based on the hanbok, the Korean hanbok, and no one would know that.
What is a hanbok?
A hanbok is a traditional dress that's worn. There's a cropped jacket over kind of a bigger skirted dress.
Okay.
Oftentimes for weddings or celebrations. And I used some of that silhouette. And I've had many heated conversations with other designers about if I am appropriating or if I'm just using it as an inspiration. And I don't think anyone would look and be like, she based that off a hanbok. But yeah. It's a heated topic that I have constantly.
The thing I like in creative things, art, music, film, is when the person who's creating it, designing it, directing it, writing it, has the conversation of where inspiration comes from. It feels like it's less of an appropriation because they're not trying to hide something.
Yeah.
You know, like whereas you'll see like maybe a scene in a film and you're like, oh, that's from this. And then the director's like, oh, I did it. And you're like, but it would be much easier just to pay respect to source materials and things, you know? Because, I mean, everyone gets ideas from different places. It's just weird when people pretend like, I invented this thing and clearly...
There's no inventions anymore in fashion.
Right.
And if there is going to be one, a new zipper. Come on, these things are crap.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we keep replacing.
There's all those zippers.
Let's see, then I just have a few things before we move on to final question.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Michael gets to go to India at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. Or Patrick. No, Patrick. Wait. I thought Patrick was grown up then and Michael's their little boy.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Is that right? Okay. Just making sure I didn't get the names mixed.
Yeah.
But the last person that went with her on a trip died. So I didn't know if it was the best choice.
The way that they had him die, too, is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't it was like echoing.
Yeah. And she like, it's pretty... I don't know. They had to move along at a fast pace because they had to have the whole writer section and this whole winter thing.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
The writer section,
it was a little boring.
It was a little drab. I mean, we don't want to see her that way. We want to see her celebrating and not being drugged down by this asshole.
But she did hook up. I mean, Agnes got impregnated by that writer, so she hooked that up, and I thought that was pretty funny.
That's true. Any final thoughts before we move on from Auntie Mame?
I think my favorite outfit, if anyone does actually watch us, is the first one when she shows up in that orange and she comes down the stairway.
Yeah.
It just exuded elegance, but so future forward.
Yeah.
That was my jam.
That's the number one.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any common misconceptions about being a fashion designer?
That it's glamorous. It's not glamorous. It's so much hard work.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're a designer, you're the first one to show up and you're the last one to leave. It might look great, but it's really hard work. And the business side of it is the most important. And people don't take business classes.
Oh, yeah.
And fashion shows are for ego, but they don't make you shit.
That was my next question, is what is it like to put together a fashion show?
It's in some ways it's enjoyable because I get to tell a story and I try to tell a story. I usually go out on stage before it walks and I give a little something.
Like a speech?
I give a little speech to kind of like bring it into context so people also to get them to shut the hell up because they're usually drunk. I sing. I sang Bang Bang for one show, which was... Everyone started singing with me, which is pretty amazing.
That's incredible.
And then I usually have an artist here in town or somewhere that I know do the music for me. So we really like collaborate. I think collaboration is really important. But
is it usually the Dandy Warhols?
It has never been the Dandy Warhols.
That's my Portland pull.
I've used a lot Milo Hayden. I don't like lyrics in my music because people start singing it and like whatever, and I prefer to have them just like sit and focus and make it cinematic. Like I want to tell a story when it walks. And what else? I don't do them much anymore. A lot of these times the fashion producers that are putting on these shows, they charge people.
Okay.
And we're talking like $5,000 and up.
Ugh.
And I always refuse because I have a really great, very wise friend that said, it's against my company policy. And you know what? Nobody needs to know how big your company is.
Yeah.
It could be just you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been saying it's against my company policy for years. And I try to teach and tell other designers that are new and getting up in the business that it really isn't worth it. If someone's trying to charge you $5,000, they're trying to make money off of you.
Right.
And that's the wrong way to go about it.
Yeah, that's really important. What is a good day like for you as a fashion designer?
A good day is waking up, getting into my studio, and feeling inspired. And I think of anyone that's creative, that could be one day out of the week. Because it can be hard. There are dark times where you're sitting there and you're like, I don't feel motivated. A good day is, I just had one in St. Louis. The Missouri Historical Museum hired a bunch of designers to take a piece out of their collection and use it for inspiration. So I was able to see my work in a museum setting next to the inspirational piece. That's a really good day.
That's incredible.
That's a good day. Because I went to art school. I didn't go for fashion. So to be able to have a piece in a museum, you're like, dang, it did work out.
Yeah.
Thanks, really expensive art school.
Do you ever look back at pieces and go, oh no, a gathered neck button keyhole faux leather cami with beaded fringe. What was I thinking?
No.
Okay, I did look up all those things. Yeah. So those are real things that hopefully would never be put together in one piece.
I am my sample size. So every sample I do, because I make my own samples and before I have them produced, I have them all in my closet. And I've yet to pull something out and go, shit, what was I thinking? I love everything still.
That's great. What's your favorite thing about being a fashion designer?
Taking a piece of fabric that is flat and just sitting there and turning it into a three-dimensional piece. It's by far my favorite thing. And I can walk into a fabric store and pull out something and know exactly what it's going to be. It just pops in my head. And I think that's why I did well at reality TV.
Yeah.
In that competition setting, because it comes to me, it's in my brain, I can push it out.
Do you have any advice for people that might be interested in fashion design? Because you found it in a different way than...
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm self-taught. I didn't go to school for fashion.
You also worked in wine for a while?
Yeah, I was a somm for 10 plus years.
Wow.
Yeah, did winemaking. I think the biggest thing is being a self-learner. If you want to do something, and I have people ask me all the time, will you teach me how to sew? And I say to them, if you can wind a bobbin and thread your machine, then I'll teach you how to sew. Do you know how many people have taken me up on that? None.
None.
Because none of them have taken out their instructional book or whatever, just try to figure it out themselves.
How do I wind a bobbin?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think in any industry, if you can't jump in and figure it out yourself, then you're not going to be good at it. And you have to have that confidence, and you have to learn how to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And if anyone was wanting to go into fashion, take some business classes.
Business, yeah. It's the same thing when Sarah was starting her food business. It was like, the first thing she was like, I have to take business classes because I can create stuff, but I don't know how to find value in it or my time or any of those things. Do you care to name drop any people in fashion that people can check out? Because we'll tag everything up in the... Post.
Definitely, you know, Alter, they're, used to be Magbag, but Alter on Hawthorne, they're the women that run it, and that's where I get all my jewelry in town, that's where I get most of my clothes, if I'm not making them, really, really great. Whom else? Wearmore.
Hmm.
Wearmore, she is on 28th off of Burnside, also another talented woman here in town. Kind of caught me off guard. I'm going to think about who else I want to draw.
It usually does when I catch people because I'm like, anybody you want, and they're tagged in the thing, so.
Who else do I love, 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 love?
Could be living or dead because sometimes people can just go back and be like, oh, this person's structural elements are really fascinating. Or
I try to keep everything local as much as possible.
Yeah, I love that.
So just my people here in town, It's where I get, I mean, all of my stuff is from either from here or when I just was in Austin and I bought a bunch of stuff from local Austin designers. I just, as much as you can keep it local, the better.
Yeah, I agree. I already asked you how long before you know you've won. It requires a entirely different skill set to be on television. What were the biggest challenges for you in going into that foray?
I've done it 3 times, and it ruined, the first 2 times ruined my relationships. The third time, wow, he's a trooper. And I think the hardest thing is not being around your family. And it does create a lot of tension. You know, you're gone for 8 weeks and you don't see them. And most of the time you don't even get to talk to them.
Wow.
So if you can imagine being away from your wife, from your daughter for 8 weeks, how big of a stress that is. It's also the best thing because it's summer camp for sewing. Like, we had food taken care of us. Like, they did our laundry for us. So you really are just focusing on being creative. And in the real world, that's not how it works. I still have my laundry to do. I've got to take the dog out. I have all these other distractions.
Yeah.
So this summer camp of creativity is amazing. But what it does to your personal life can be really overwhelming.
And was there anything you were surprised that you were good at? Like, either talking on camera or... They're not asking you to retake takes, right?
No, not at all.
They're just filming and cutting the raw footage.
Yeah. They called me the producer because, let's say your challenge is you have to make resort wear. Sewing is quiet. Designing is quiet. Mm-hmm. That does not make a good TV show. So I'd be the one that would pipe up and be like, hey, Dimitri, where are you going to, if you could go on a trip right now, where would you go? So just like throwing that stuff in that ends up making the cuts, because otherwise we're just quietly sewing. It's so boring.
So, there's so much. Oh, man.
Yeah. That's so you got to make that stuff up. I'm like, you know, you also have to have fun with your, you know, these are some of my best friends. There are very few that I don't like, but, you know, there's a fart corner. Nobody knows about that.
Nobody knows about a fart corner.
Yeah. We're powered by hummus. Like,
think of
how much on that, the table that you can eat, the craft table. It's hummus. Yeah.
And baby carrots.
Oh my gosh. So much farting. So much farting.
So there's a designer fart corner.
There is. Yeah.
That's a big reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I hope people listen to the end of the episode for that. And what a great time to mention my favorite and final question.
Yes.
Michelle, what are your dreams like?
There are lots of anxiety. So it's me falling or jumping off of bridges or like, yeah.
Well, the falling makes sense if you jump off a bridge.
I mean, like, maybe not just bridges, but also, like, I don't know, out of planes, or it's all high spaces that I'm jumping off of, and it's super anxiety-ridden. Or the other dreams are tigers surrounding my house.
Oh, my gosh.
I have a lot of anxiety.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I initially meant the question because when I, like, would work in retail, you have dreams about folding shirts. Oh. But then I took all that preface out, and people... Their dreams are, it's probably one of my favorite parts.
Oh. Because
it's just wildly different from person to person.
I'm excited to hear what these dreams are that other people aren't
having. One person said that they dream in the same series of houses, which means they have like a dream neighborhood where their dreams are taking place.
Like The Sims.
Yeah, but just their dreams.
Huh.
But anyway, no. Michelle, I can't thank you enough for coming here
for
talking about Auntie Mame, for introducing it to me. It's a first-time watch for me, so you're still doing the good work and giving people the book and spreading the word. It's a fantastic film that I hope people watch. Much continued success.
Thank you.
I hope I see you sooner than later.
Yes, please.
Everyone, thank you for listening to VHS. I'm your host, Dirk Marshall, and tune in next episode where I speak to a different person with a different profession about a different movie.
How different.
Links to our guest and topics of the conversation are up on the website vh-us.com. Please share our episode with anyone who you think would be interested. Rate, review, and what have you on your preferred platforms. If you would like to follow along visually, our Instagram is vh.us. If you're going to be in Portland, Oregon, or you live in Portland, Oregon, and you would like to be a guest, then please put guest and your profession in the heading of the email. If you'd like to recommend a movie, then please put movie and the title in the heading. Thank you for listening. I'd also like to thank my engineer, JL, and my producer, Wade Allen, and of course, my amazing wife, Sarah Marshall. Until next time, I'm Dirk Marshall, and this has been VHS.